From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, psychoactive listeners. Well, we're approaching the end of the second season of Psychoactive, but in thinking about how I'd like the last or penultimate episode to be, the notion of getting more personal and going more deeply into the issue and the questions around MDMA seemed to me a good one. Now, obviously, we've talked about MDMA before. There was the episode with Rick Doblin talking about his history of MDMA and the trials that are hopefully result in the FDA approving MDMA in the next year or so. But our guest today is somebody who's not an MDMA psychotherapist. He doesn't do psychotherapy with MDMA. He's not part of the trials that MAPS has been moving forward and others, but he's deeply knowledgeable about the subject. His name is Charlie Wininger. He's the author of a book a couple of years ago called Listening to Ecstasy, The Transformative Power of MDMA. Now, he's a licensed psychoanalyst and mental health counselor in New York. He's been in private practice more than 30 years. Some years ago, the New York Times and Newsday nicknamed him the quote-unquote love doctor because of his work with singles. But now he's specializing more in relationships and communication skills and dealing with love and couples and also grief. But I also asked Charlie to invite his wife, Shelley, on the program as well, Shelley Wininger, in part because the book and story he tells in Listening to Ecstasy is so much about the relationship. I mean, the two of them, when I crossed paths with them in New York City, they are an inseparable couple. And something about them almost reminded me of Sasha and Anne Shulgin. If you think about their book, Pikal, where half the book is the chemical recipes for all sorts of psychedelic substances. The other one is the story of their love story and their use of various substances. So, Charlie, Shelley, thank you ever so much for joining me and my listeners on Psychoactive.
Thank you, Ethan. It's wonderful to be here.
Charlie, I'll tell you, reading your book, I mean, it's really almost a story of three loves: your love with Shelley, your love of MDMA and its value, and then a third story about your love of community and the communities you're part of, and that you've helped organize and curate. And so, let me just start By asking you, I mean, much of your book involves, you know, the period 20 odd years ago when you and Shelley meet and it's your second marriages and you fall in love. And we'll get into that story. But in terms of your earlier history of MDMA, had you done it before? Had it been less valuable to you in your life? Was there a pre-story there?
MDMA was not valuable to me at all until I met Shelley. I had given it up. I had only done it alone and recreationally. I didn't know about the protocols at the time. I'm going back to the 90s. And I didn't know about hydrating. I didn't know about not mixing it with alcohol, all these basic fundamental mistakes. So I had given it up for dead. I thought that this was a substance without substance. Then I met Shelley, and Shelley was like just recently sprung from a regressive marriage, and she wanted to spread her wings. And when she found out about my hippie past, and I don't know if it's all in the past, and she found out that I was a psychonaut and had been a psychonaut for 30 years by the time I met her 20 years ago, she said she wanted me to corrupt her, basically. So I set about doing so. And the first time we did MDMA together was a true revelation for both of us. Just seeing her come on, seeing her climb on MDMA was like, I mean, to my mind, she was beautiful to begin with, and full of innocence and joy. And suddenly I realized that, yeah, this is the chemical of connection. This chemical is not to be done alone. When I was alone, I felt like I was, and rolling alone, I felt like I was all dressed up with nowhere to go. It's really about connecting with myself, but also with another, and in time, many others, and intentional experiences that we curated later on.
Well, let me ask, you know, at one point you say in the book, Charlie, that what you love most, or that you find that you came to recognize the things that you love most about Shelley and MDMA are similar. And I wonder, yes. Shelley, would you say the same about Charlie and MDMA?
What do you mean by similar?
Well, Charlie, what did you mean by similar?
Well, that MDMA gets me right in the moment, and that's really where Shelley lives. I have a more of a, my mind is heavy and convoluted, and I'm always thinking about the past and the future. Shelley is more in the here and now, and that's what MDMA does for me as well. So that's a similarity right there.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say it also, for me, at the very first time, I felt alive. I had been very oppressed, I guess, between my mother and my ex-husband. And all of a sudden, everything, all my little handcuffs were released. And I felt beautiful. It was just amazing.
And the drug has continued to work for the two of you.
Oh, yeah.
After many dozens of, because now you're using it, I think you said in the book, try 3 or 4 times a year. And you've been together for over 20 years?
Well, we've done about 80 rolls together.
Experience, basically.
Correct. In the last 20 years, yes. And, you know, another similarity is that MDMA gets me and other people I've met into a state of complete innocence, like a childlike, just happy to be alive and be with somebody else that they like, just very simple and innocent and joyful. And Shelley is really, I experience her as a very, her spirit is very innocent and joyful. So that's another way that they are similar.
Well, you know, I mean, what really stands out for me in your book is the ways in which you can, I mean, we'll talk about the ways in which you can get MDMA to being a psychotherapist, but it's about the notion of healthy aging. I mean, you specifically say healthy aging is not just for older people, but also for younger people as well. But, you know, here, I mean, there's a sense in which I'm reading your book, and I mean, here we are, you and I were two, you know, bald-headed, white-goateed senior citizens, right, dealing with aging in various ways, and also deeply immersed in, a psychedelic community in New York and more broadly, right? And the issues around aging, you know, as our bodies age, as all sorts of things age and stuff like that. But you talk about the role of MDMA in healthy aging is an absolutely pivotal ingredient to making aging work well. So just say a little more about that.
I've learned that, and this I really only learned through having all these experiences over the years with MDMA. It seems to have a cumulative effect, at least for me. So many experiences of being for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours feeling completely ageless, giving me a sense of what it's like to feel like really 10, 20, 30, 40 years younger than I am. For that period of time, I can dance like I'm not even dancing. I'm being danced like the MDMA is the puppeteer and the marionette, and I'm being danced and moving so light on my feet. And it helped me realize that aging is that I've been brainwashed about it. I think we all have. You know, like the brainwashing goes like this: past age 25, your stock goes down a point a year in terms of your worth into society or socially, and so that's why we are all on a hell-bent mission to try to say, "Oh, I'm not old. I'm young at heart." Like old itself is a dirty word. That's like ridiculous and oppressive. So I, you know, somebody looks at me now and they say, you know, you look about, 60, 65. I want to shake them up and they'll say, excuse me, I'm about to be 74 years old and I earned every year and I'm happy and proud to be this age. I don't want to be mistaken for younger as if that's some sort of compliment. It's not a compliment. It's actually a backhanded insult when somebody says, you look good for your age. I'm sorry. You look good for a, and fill in the blank, with any other demographic, and it would be an insult. But you look good for your age means that you don't look as old as you really are, as if that's supposed to be make you more valuable in some way. So I realized through doing MDMA a lot that all this was oppressing me, and that at any age in my life, I am every age. In other words, MDMA helped me get in touch with my 8-year-old, my 18-year-old, my 28-year-old, and I can do that when I'm sober. Because my inner child or my inner 18-year-old or my inner 30-year-old has things to tell me and things to remind me of, and that this vitality and spontaneity that I had then is still available to me. And so MDMA has really helped me across the adult lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Well, for our listeners, let me just read a few lines from the book, from Charlie's book, Listening to Ecstasy. He says at one point, there are two boxes in this world one needs to avoid as best one can. The box they put you in when you die and the one they try to put you in when you're alive. I found the best way to delay the former is to live a life outside the latter. And then at another point, he describes MDMA as an emotional decongestant. And says, I found my ability to appreciate and benefit from medicines like MDMA ripens with age, that for him, it's a chemical hedge against feeling like aging's victim and against age-related fear. Here we have not an antidote, but a salve, a tonic, a rejuvenating vacation that can replenish the fountain of one's youth. Shelley, the same for you?
Absolutely. When I roll, I do become ageless. I don't think of how old I am. And because even when I'm not rolling, my brain still feel young.
I mean, I'll tell you, in reading your book, I had really almost two kind of emotional reactions to it. One was how much it reminded me of what I loved about MDMA in my relationships in the past, you know, and the role it played that, you know, in my relationship with my first wife, where I think, you know, we were at the verge of divorce and we did it. And it was really eye-opening and more than eye-opening, soul-opening. And even though it didn't result in saving our marriage, it helped us to a softer landing. And then in subsequent relationships, it was just this incredibly valuable tool. And also, in terms of talking things through, in terms of being clear with one, and being able to not just say things well, but hear things well. And I also noticed, even the very first time I did it, about being in my body. It wasn't I burst out. Well, I guess there was some dancing there. I mean, but I remember feeling the energy. I'd always felt that the energy in my body was very, very much in my torso. And I never felt all that grounded. And the first time I did MDMA, I could almost feel the energy pushing itself down my legs to kind of become more grounded. And then on the music, I remember the music we put on, it was something called Earth Tribe Rhythm. It was this wonderful dancing music, this drumming and electronic music that was just, you know, just inspiring. It just would, you know, dance like crazy, the same way that you're describing. But in the book, you talk about some other things. You talk about music and a good sound system. You talk about anchoring. Say something more, first of all, about what music goes well with what and why.
Well, depends what you want to do. A comedian once said, I heard him on the TV, he said, with MDMA, people like to dance to EDM. And he says, you know what EDM stands for? It means everyone's doing Molly. So I like EDM, electronic dance music, of course, is what it really stands for. And because that's for dancing. And also for me, good old rock and roll. If I'm feeling more calm and just hanging out with my love, we might put on some Buddha bar or trip hop exotic Buddha lounge and different playlists like that.
And Shelley, you share the same taste with Charlie in this matter?
Oh, yeah. when I first met him, I raised two children, so I was listening to a lot of kids' stuff and listening to show tunes. So I introduced him to show tunes. He introduced me to old-fashioned rock and roll. And little by little, over the years, we started playing with different kinds of music, and we found Buddha Lounge for softer, like edgier music or Buddha Lounge, Buddha Bar, which is softer. It's also very sexual, so that's nice.
Well, so I want to get into the sexual thing in a moment, but what about mixing MDMA with other drugs? Whether it's, I guess, called like candy flipping when you do with LSD, or some people like combining with marijuana, either before, during, or after. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts about all of that?
Well, New Year's Eve, we candy flipped, which we like to do. If we can't make it to the Fish concert because they want $200,000 a ticket, we can't make it to Fish on New Year's Eve at Madison Square Garden, then we'll candy flip at home with MDMA and LSD. And that tends to put us over the edge, really. It tends to put us in a very blissful, deeply sensual space. But even then, if we're just doing MDMA and we want to get it on, which I always do with my ageless angel, we will wait till the end of the roll, because it's hard for I just punned there. It's a bad pun. It's difficult. It's hard for a man to stay hard on MDMA. At least that's the experience of a lot of men. So we wait till the end of the roll as we're coming down and add cannabis to it. Shelley will take an edible, which she has a lot of very valuable things to talk about that. And I will just take some, smoke some sativa, and then we can have what I like to call sextasy, where we're just having an amazing sexual encounter at the end of a roll.
So let me shift here to Shelley. So Shelley, in terms of cannabis and MDMA and these other things, I mean, throughout this book, and obviously you must have given your okay for Charlie to do this, he describes you as this incredibly sexual, sensual, orgasmic, you know, ever more so as you age. I mean, it's a wonderful description. One element reminded me of part of the things that Anne Shulgin writes about when she does 2CB with Sasha. You know, I remember in that thing she talks about doing 2CB at one point and just totally going through this horrific depression, ego destruction. And then Sasha appears at the door and the thing does a 180 and flips into this utter beauty. And she has the biggest, most sustained orgasms of her life. She thereby, by the way, set a lot of people up for failure when it came to like jumping, let's do 2CB and have sex, because people, if you just go into that way, often it's just not going to work that way. But I'm curious, Shelley. So when Charlie's describing you in this way, I'm assuming that you verified everything he wrote about you in this book. So when it comes to these different drugs, and in terms of sexuality, and I understand that you're oftentimes, you know, that you, part of what you do is actually teaching younger women about learning about their sexuality. So tell us about your sexuality, and especially as you've gotten older, and the various medicines or substances that you're using.
Do you have about a week?
Well, not exactly, but how about the highlights?
Okay, the highlights. First of all, I found when we lived in our first apartment, I was just starting to go through menopause, and we could hear the people in the next apartment, which meant they could hear us. So I realized I was very controlled, and I was sexual, but not until we moved to our apartment now, where we have another building next to our building. So set and setting for me changed completely. And that made me feel free. I could be more verbal, which does help. It's only been about 2 years now I've been playing with edible cannabis because I have a vocal cord problem. And my doctor told me to use edible, because the vape was causing problems. Well, I started using cannabis, the edible, and it like changed me completely. They say that the brain is the largest sex organ in our body, and I've been taking advantage of that. It focuses on me. And many times I will take it before Charlie's ready for me, and I just play with music. I'll listen to music. I'll start focusing it on different parts of my body. I'll start touching different parts of my body. I'm learning more and more about my body even now. And I feel that a lot of women don't know their body. They don't know. A lot of them don't even know that they're, what kind of orgasms there are, how many orgasms. I call my little ones orgs. I have lots of orgs. And I started playing with music where I would listen to different kinds of music, and as it would vibrate, I would focus the vibration down below. And I found I could have an orgasm without touching myself, just using the music in my brain. And when people hear that, they're like, oh, my God. Because I have to use edibles, which stay in your body longer and I think really affect the body maybe differently, I can't talk for people who smoke or, you know, who vape, whatever. I can only talk about edibles. But it's very interesting, and I'm still learning. And I'll tell you a very quick story. When I was in nursing school back in 1969, it started. 1969, 1970, a gynecologist came to talk to the whole freshman class, because we were all getting, you know, we're 18 years old, 19 years old, living in New York City. He was talking to us about the birth control pill, and then he talked about something called the pelvic tilt. Now, I was a virgin. I really knew nothing about sex. A few months ago, during sex, I realized I was doing the pelvic tilt he was talking about 50 years ago. And it meant just moving my body up so that he was rubbing against my clitoris and giving me an orgasm. So that was like, whoa, it only took me 50-something
and
years.
And this you just came across recently.
Yeah.
What a wonderful discovery.
Yes. Right. I do cannabis every week. But like on New Year's Eve when we candy flipped, I ended up taking a little piece of edible. And because the MDMA seemed to be overpowering the LSD, and we wanted to have sex. So I took a little piece of edible, and about within an hour, all of a sudden, the tapestry over our bed is moving. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm tripping. And Charlie's like, oh, you mean did the cannabis help the MDMA? I'm like, no. And I only took a little piece of acid. I said, it activated the acid. For the first time, I was quote unquote tripping balls.
Uh-huh.
I had never done that much before. And it was very, very different. Sex at that point, I couldn't do because I could barely speak. So
we'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
In the book, right, Charlie, you talk about the importance of anchoring, right? That during the MDMA experience, that one's getting the emotional, psychological insights, and that one wants to kind of be conscious at that time of how one can come back to those places. But I'm wondering, both for you and Shelley, whether that's also true about sexuality, like even leaving apart the cannabis, does one get to places with the LSD or MDMA and sexuality that one can then anchor and think about how one comes back to those, that space without the use of substances, in subsequent days, weeks, or the rest of one's life?
Yes. And one great way to anchor the experience is with the use of music. And this is described in the book, but also when you're high on whatever substance and you get into a piece of music that you love, and if it's a piece of music that makes you feel erotic, sensual, you can make note of that and remember that. And then afterwards, days or weeks later, when you're sober, you can play that music again and turn down the lights and light some candles and hang out with your partner or yourself and get into that same sensual or sexual mood.
Shelley, I mean, is it that way for you as well? I mean, is there a sense of that, oh my God, factor saying I can get back here without these drugs?
Yes and no. When Charlie proposed to me, I was ecstatic, obviously. He proposed to me on a Friday. That next day, we had planned to go up to a state park upstate, which we did, and we took MDMA. And I listened to a song by Enya called Flora's Secret, because we were like the only ones in this field. The sun was shining, and Flora's Secret's about flowers. I listened to it about 25, 30 times while under the influence of MDMA. Even today, 20 some odd years later, or 15, 17 years later, I can listen to that song and be brought back to the feeling of lying under the sun, being on MDMA, even now. Mm. That's the most impressive one that I find. It still amazes me. There are some psychedelic songs that Charlie plays sometimes, like the Chambers Brothers, Time Has Come Today. It's a very... How
trippy.
Would you put it, Charlie?
Trippy song. I'm talking about the long version, the FM version, the 11-minute version. Time Has Come Today. It's 1967, one of the best psychedelic songs ever produced.
And when I hear that song, it just puts me in the mood, no matter what I'm on or if anything.
What a blessing this has been for me. If you asked me at age 30, 40, or 50 what my sex life would be as a 73-year-old man, I would have frowned and said, I dread what would happen, what will happen. But our sex life keeps ripening, keeps blossoming. And my wife, this I call her my ageless angel. She's more sexual than ever before. So I'm just so blessed to have found her.
Well, let me ask this question. I mean, Shelley, what you're describing is obviously just, you know, you started using edibles 2 years ago, but that's when Charlie's book came out, and he's already describing you as this incredibly sexual being before that. And also about MDMA. So I'm curious, Shelley, what about with MDMA? I mean, Charlie describes, and it's been sometimes my experience as well, that MDMA could lead to really exquisite sex, although virtually never ending, for me at least, in an orgasm, that it was almost impossible to orgasm, but that one could get an incredibly sensual, you know, loving, sexy, just delicious, delightful place.
Yes.
But what about from your perspective in terms of MDMA and sex?
Okay. One time at a music festival, I was standing up and swaying to the music, and apparently I was rubbing my legs together. I had an orgasm. I was on MDMA at the time. Yes.
And if we are together in bed and the MDMA is still very active, the best thing I can do for her is go down on her at that time, because it might be hard for me to get or stay hard, but I can do other things.
You know, I really appreciate your sharing these stories here. On the other hand, I also wonder, you know, I mean, Charlie, I have to say, in reading your book, and, you know, you're offering a lot of wisdom and guidance about healthy aging and about sexuality, but it also, you know, I keep having this, you know, questioning thing. Well, but Charlie, maybe you just met the perfect woman to have this relationship with. And it's less about the drug and it's more about the woman. And obviously the drug is helping these things along. You know, but I mean, you talk in the book about, you know, for the first when you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, for you, it was always finding some woman who was highly intellectual and was all going to, you know, ups and downs mood-wise and was inevitably going to be, there's going to be a lot of, you know, a lot of excitement, but a lot of grief. And then you describe meeting Shelley, who is just this magical partner for you. And I wonder about, you know, I don't want you to have to go think about this, but assuming you had never met Shelley, I mean, would this whole evolution in your life with MDMA and sexual, I mean, could you even envision it having happened? Or was she just the key to all of this?
You make a good point. I mean, Shelley and I are unusually compatible. But the thing is, Ethan, that I think the ageism, the internalized ideas that we inhale from this culture about what to expect from ourselves and our partners or our future partners as we age is debilitating because we expect less in terms of sexual connection. And, you know, often women, they go through menopause and many women feel like, I'm done with sex. That's it. I don't want to have sex anymore. And that's obviously a very valid choice. All we're saying is that there's another option. And that couples don't have to settle for a sexless marriage if they don't want to. If they're having emotional troubles because they're fighting and that gets reflected in a lack of a sex life, okay, well, then you need couples counseling because I've found that, you know, it can get better with couples counseling. Shelley and I have been to a couples counselor many times because we're human. We hit snags along the way, but we are unusually compatible. Sex to have a sexually alive marriage is possible across the whole adult lifespan. And, you know, there's a whole spectrum of sexuality between two people. It's not just about intercourse. It can be about affection. Shelley and I are affectionate through the day and through the week with each other. We keep that aliveness there, that connection there. And that was influenced not only by our strong love for each other, but by MDMA that helped us stay in the moment and realize that our bodies are where we live. And when I touch her, mm-hmm. I feel her touching me, and it brings me out of whatever craziness rumination I have in my head. I wake up in the morning and I'm full of a thousand thoughts. I walk into the kitchen, she stands up and wants to hug me, and my day is made at that point because she just squeezes all the nonsense out of me at that moment that I come to, and I'm really awake then for the rest of the day.
You know, Charlie, one thing you do spend a lot of time on in the latter part of the book is dealing, on the one hand, with ageism in our society, and not just ageism in terms of young people kind of making assumptions about people who look older, but also in the ways in which those assumptions are internalized. And then you describe how you and Shelley do something which I can relate to a lot, which is you oftentimes find yourself in environments, parties, things like that, where you're far and away the oldest people there. right? Yes. Where most of the people are in their 20s or 30s, and there you are in your late 60s or early 70s, and what that's like. And what you describe, I think, is, I mean, first of all, a lack of inhibition on both your part and even more so Shelley's part, that's actually rejuvenating. And sort of, you know, just stimulates a kind of renewed vitality where you can feel your younger self, and even your body, for at least for those hours, can feel dramatically younger than it actually is.
When we are with younger people, and it's often with people in the psychedelic community, suddenly those old notions of, I call them apartheid, age segregation that exists in a town like New York City, it falls away. And the benefit is two-way. It's in both directions. We benefit by being around younger people who are filled with vitality and a freshness that you ordinarily don't see in 60s and 70s and 80-year-olds. So we benefit from that. They benefit from seeing us, sometimes they want to, you know, just be around us to gain whatever wisdom they think we might have. But also they want to be around us because they see the love between us. It's palpable, and it gives them hope for their future. If they're single, it gives them hope to have a relationship that works like ours does. But if they're coupled, they can see that, yeah, the love can keep going and keep growing through the decades.
But I mean, it sounds like you're trying to send a message to that. On the one hand, the psychedelics community is quite accepting of this age spectrum. But
yes,
even so, to be in a kind of partying environment is unusual. And you guys are sort of role models. And you talk in back the fact that seeing yourselves as owning the notion of yourself as elders. And
yes,
even, you know, not quite putting it in people's face, but saying we are elders and there's something to. So, I mean, when did that first hit you that you're an elder, that you and Shelley are elders in all of this?
When we would go to a rave and people would come up to us invariably and say, I'm so glad you're here. You give me hope. They use a different line sometimes than the one your friend got. They said, you're what I want to be when I don't grow up. People are grateful to us for showing up and showing that it's possible to keep the party going across the whole lifespan.
Uh-huh. Shelley, you share this feeling of being an elder in the community?
Oh, absolutely. I had a woman come over to me back in October. We were at a party, and she wanted to know what, she was in her like early 30s. Do I have any advice for her? And I said, and I had to think because nobody's ever really asked me about advice. And I said, go with your gut feeling, because I have learned that if the gut is telling me one thing, it's usually the right thing.
I like to say that the best part of the psychedelic community isn't the psychedelics. It's the community. It's the people who are drawn to these medicines are among the most open-hearted, open-minded, curious, seeking people that I would ever want to meet. And so we've lucked out in this way. And to be elders, it just seems... I feel like we're in the right place at the right time, especially in the middle of a renaissance. I mean, it's fabulous.
Well, you know, in the book, Charlie, you put this in some historical context. I mean, at one point you say, I wonder if my shift in drugs of choice from cocaine when I was younger to MDMA corresponds to a larger shift in the zeitgeist, one to a more feminine ethic. Consider the code names for these two drugs, Blow and Molly. And then you talk about, you know, two key moments in 2004 and 5, I think it was. First, when Peter Jennings, the ABC News correspondent, does his special about MDMA called Ecstasy Rising. And then around the same time when Alex Gray, the famous psychedelicist painter, and his wife Allison, also a painter, you know, create the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, COSM, COSM, and when that opens in New York and sort of opens up a culture. So it does seem that there was, I mean, here, you and Shelley had, what, met in the late 90s or around 2000? And
2000.
Then a few years later, there's this kind of both, you know, public media opening with Peter Jennings thing, and then with Alex and Allison Gray doing COSM. I mean, when you reflect back on that time, I mean, what did it feel like then? Or was it, you know, were you just in the right place and right time to be, you know, part of this wave, or was it just part of a broader zeitgeist that was happening, you know, that is
it
now
was,
changing the world?
Like I say, we're in the right place at the right time, and we still are. COSM opened in October 1st, 2004. I tell the whole story in the book. And Roland Griffiths was doing this breakthrough work at Johns Hopkins, where they realizing that psilocybin can have these terrific beneficial effects for people, and that was getting, that was the first wave of publicity that LSD or magic mushrooms or MDMA that had been damned by the government and the culture are actually solutions. They're not drug problems, they're drug solutions. And the narrative around these substances began to change back then.
And don't forget that in 2003, after Ecstasy Rising, was when we started our first potlucks.
Ah.
Where we were able to that's a very important part of our life.
It's true.
Yeah. But listen, to go back to what you were just talking about there about community, that COSM, Chapel of Sacred Memories, you know, inspires a kind of pop-up parties. You guys have your first gathering, and that, you know, and that's part of the places where you're interacting with much younger people. But it's clear, Charlie, that you're very conscious, and I guess really both of you, you and Shelley, in terms of bringing people together, you know, emphasizing the value of community. Sometimes this involves MDMA, sometimes it does not. But just, you know, I mean, I'm really impressed, and I know you've invited me numerous times to come to one of these gatherings, and I do intend, in fact, sooner than later, to say yes to that. But say more about these gatherings and their importance. And the importance.
Sure.
As I said at the beginning, you described your three loves, right? Shelley, MDMA, and the communities that you're part of. So talk about community.
Well, we wanted to host here. MAPS had sent out an email saying anyone who wants to host a screening of the Peter Jennings interview, a show called Ecstasy Rising in 2004, just let us know. So we let them know. And they sent a bunch of people our way. And we all watched this together. That was our first potluck. We all watched it together, and we were talking till like 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning because we had found each other. So every year after that, we would host a potluck in our apartment, reaching out to MAPS to say, you know, tell people in the New York City vicinity and that we are opening our homes to other MAPS members. And over the years, it would grow, and finally, we couldn't contain it to one night anymore. It grew to two nights and then three nights. Now, these years, we have people coming in over four nights, 20, 25 people per night from the MAPS and the larger community, too, here in New York City, the psychedelic community. And these are just blissful events because they're sober events, except for a little wine or beer. It's a potluck and it's sober, and we're talking about a topic that people agree on beforehand that they want to talk about, like sex, drugs, and intimacy, or whatever the topic is. And people get to meet, and friendships get born on these nights, that friendships that have lasted for years, even decades now. This coming year, into 2023, we will be celebrating our 20th anniversary of our potluck dinners, and we're going to do something special to do this and get a whole lot of people together for a night. Maybe rent a boat to go around Manhattan. I don't know what we're going to do, but we usually do this later in the year. But we've also hosted, besides the potlucks, we've hosted definitely non-sober experiences in Prospect Park, where we'll just gather people together, 25 people, 35 people, 45 people. And to the outside world, it just looks like a bunch of people having a picnic, except for the occasional cuddle puddle. But we're just having a blissful time together for the day and for people who participate in that. And anyone can do this, by the way, any listener of this show. You know people, or you can find people who will do this with you, and it's a wonderful way to get to know people. There's no better way to spend the day than rolling together on MDMA and just getting to know each other. And because, it, as you know, MDMA opens the heart and opens the mind, and just to make that connection, people want to stay connected after these group experiences for years, and they do. It's a great way to make new friendships, and it's been a wonderful blessing for Shelley and I.
Charlie, is there any advice you can tell listeners about how they actually can? Are there websites or anything else to figure out how you tap into this community in your local area?
Well, yeah, there are many websites. Certainly, if somebody wants to tap into the community, they can send me an email. You can get into my website at listeningtoecstasy.com or charliewininger.com and cjwininger@gmail.com is my email address. But they're also, like here in New York, there's a Brooklyn Psychedelic Society, which is very popular. And there are psychedelic societies all over the country. You just have to do some digging. They're not underground. It's not a place to go to get high. It's not a place to go to find a source. It's a place to go to meet other people. And sometimes it's on meetup.org. Or you can start your own psychedelic society in your town. Believe me, there are people within 10 miles of you, lots of people within 10 miles of you who are doing psychedelics, and they're just keeping it quiet like you might be keeping it quiet. But they're out there and they want to meet you. So there are friendships waiting to be made.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Now, Chai, I want to take up another issue, though, with you, which is you also describe some history of struggling with substance abuse, with cocaine and with amphetamine and having a father who was alcoholic. And you also then talk about how MDMA has helped you in that regard. That if any, you know, whereas you have to be careful, there are people who can get addicted to MDMA. It is possible, and people do abuse it in that way. But it also can be helpful. So just say more about that.
Well, yeah, it's a whole story. But I was struggling with cocaine for a while. And the best definition of cocaine I ever heard was Robin Williams calling it the devil's dandruff. It just, I mean, for some people it works, I'm sure, but for me, it worked me. The cocaine was doing me. I wasn't doing cocaine. It was abusing me. And I realized that I had to quickly make a choice. It was going to win or I was going to win. So, I found two keys, one legal and one not legal. The not legal key for me was MDMA, because I soon discovered that MDMA was a far, far superior medicine, because it lasts longer, because it doesn't have addictive qualities like cocaine notoriously does. Not everyone gets addicted to cocaine who uses it, but a lot of people do. I was getting there. And MDMA is not addictive for me and for most people, and it lasts a lot longer. It's a whole lot cheaper. It has all kinds of benefits. The legal route that helped me was very dark chocolate, and I'm talking about 100% bitter chocolate. Most people eat chocolate for the taste. I eat it for the effect, because it sends me in just a little bit of the same direction of cocaine or MDMA. It's a stimulant, and it's a mood elevator. And so I'm now a chocoholic, which is a perfectly functional addiction to have, and I'll eat 100% dark chocolate with dates in it, and it's just wonderful, and it elevates my mood, and it helps sex as well, and it's healthy. So these things have helped me. I haven't done cocaine in about 11-12 years now, and so I'm very happy about that.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about how your MDMA use has shaped your approach to being a psychotherapist, I mean, is it a monumental impact on that, or just kind of it's helped you refine, be more empathic? I mean, what are the key? What's the relationship there?
It's helped me become a better therapist, because I mean, I was fairly empathetic to begin with, but of course MDMA helps amplify one's proclivity towards empathy. And having had 80 roles, I know what it feels like in my heart to empathize with somebody physically, and I can anchor that and bring it into the therapy session. I do therapy sober. The client is sober and I am sober, but I found that the best therapy I can do, that I can provide, is if I can try to create an atmosphere, an environment in the therapy room that replicates the MDMA experience. And what I mean by that is being receptive to the person, listening deeply into and through exact all that they're saying and all that they're conveying, really being there and reflecting back to them what I hear, and empathizing and showing compassion as best as I can. And when they feel safe, their defenses can come down a bit. And when the defenses come down, they can come out a bit. and risk being vulnerable right there in the therapy session. And that's where the healing can really start taking place.
And when we think about MDMA, I mean, obviously, the research that's being done now by MAPS in terms of treating PTSD, and there's all the looking at its value in other areas, maybe including addiction, maybe including eating disorders, maybe including, fear around end of life. But when we think about MDMA and helping people deal with grief or the grief, the loss of a loved one, what can you say about that?
How much time do we have, Ethan?
I mean, I'm hesitant because, I know when we all had dinner with some friends last year, and Shelley, you told the story about the loss of your son, and also about how I think MDMA was helpful in dealing with that. But I don't know if you want to go there. I know it's painful to talk about. So, Shelley, if you're willing to share that story, I think it would be interesting and enlightening for our listeners.
Okay, so on May 13th, my son died. He was 39 years old. And this was in 2021. We already knew that we were going to have a group role. And people were asking, was Shelley going to be in on it? And I said, absolutely. To use MDMA to help me in my grief, it could be perfect. So we went to Prospect Park, and about an hour and a half or so into the experience, Charlie called us into a circle, whoever wanted to participate. There was one person who came down from Boston. Actually, he had lost his mother the same day that I lost my son. And he spoke about his mother a little bit. And then other people who had lost people in the past year had spoken about their people. And then it was my turn. And when somebody had enlarged a photograph for me, and when I opened it up, I saw the photograph. I just started crying a little bit.
A photograph of Scott.
A photograph of my son. And then Charlie said that what he said to the group, that what he didn't tell me was that day, that when after I heard what happened, Charlie and I were sitting on the couch, and Charlie said he felt Scott, my son's name was Scott, he felt Scott's presence in the living room.
I felt Scott's presence in the living room the day he died, and he was hovering above, and this man who was 39 years old, who had been suffering all his life from mental illness and physical maladies. He was in a lot of pain. He was smiling down at the two of us, and he said, I'm free. And at that, when I said that in front of Shelley to the whole group there in Prospect Park, she burst like a dam. And so he began sobbing.
And as I was sobbing, I could start to feel people, energy around me, people coming, touching my head, my shoulders, my legs. And I don't know how long I sobbed. I kind of lost who I was, and it wasn't until I don't even know how long I sobbed. But then I realized I was kind of emptying myself out. And because of the MDMA, I realized this afterwards, of course, and because of the MDMA, I was able to receive their love and everything, because they were on MDMA and they were able to give. And when I opened my eyes, it was a bit strange. I didn't see people at first. I can only describe it like spirits. And they were dark, but I just felt calm. And when I opened my eyes, when it cleared,
I saw people, and it was beautiful. I thanked them and said how it's really helped me start my healing. And then I had told Charlie earlier that I wanted to dance. Whatever happens in this circle, I don't know what's going to happen, but I want to dance to celebrate life. And that's what we did.
Then I put some dance music on and we danced, and it was really an ecstatic moment. Because of the MDMA, like Shelley said, she could feel without hesitation just at that moment when she heard me say that Scott said he was free, she could just really expel all that grief and let it completely out. We left her empty. And then when she opened her eyes, she could see all these loving people around her, and she could just let herself fill up with their love. And so the grief got replaced with the love. And sure, Shelley still has grief for her, the passing of her son. Of course, she will for the rest of her life, but she's never been debilitated by it because of that moment. It was not just MDMA that did it. It was MDMA in community and with the intention of healing that did it. A few days later, we got an email from a friend who was there who said, I never want to go to a traditional wake or funeral again for the rest of my life. This is the way to honor somebody who has passed. This is the way to heal those who have felt, who feel the passing the most.
Wow. Well, that's, I thank you so much for sharing that story, Charlie and Shelley. So on that somewhat somber note, I want to thank you, both of you, for taking the time to have this wonderful conversation and with me and my listeners on Psychoactive. So thank you ever so much, Charlie and Shelley.
Thank you so much.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian. And a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, for what will be the final episode of Season 2, we have my old friend and ally Steve Rolls, longtime senior policy analyst at the British organization Transform, talking with me about models and realities in legalizing cannabis and other drugs.
If you are actually in the position of making the reforms and drafting the legislations which shape the nature of the market from the outset, you have the power to do things very differently. And that's why you do have the possibility of social equity programs that restrict licensing or preference licensing for impacted communities. And you are able to legislate that 40% or 70% of tax revenue is redirected into impacted communities. Let's use cannabis regulations as an opportunity to show how drugs can be regulated and how markets can be regulated in the interests of the communities in which those markets exist.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.